pretty scary. It was probably, it felt like 150 mile hour winds. I mean, it was whipping pretty good.
It started at 2 a.m. and we were in our house until it got to about mid-thigh.
We're 90% underwater. Every home out there is destroyed.
I called 911, asked them could they, somebody come and help me. I was too afraid, and the dispatcher told me she didn't know when the lights would come back on.
The water did rise and came in, and it wouldn't stop.
There are so many debris piles still, moldy furniture and couch cushions, rolls of carpet that have been ripped out of someone's house and put on the curb, even clothes and shoes just kind of piled up in these little hills everywhere you look in some of these neighborhoods.
Families and business owners in Houston have to get their lives back on track.
Us handicapped people, they had a retirement home not too far from here. They could let us go there instead of sleeping on these hard cots, and I was so heavy, hurting so bad I had to sit up in a chair many nights and sleep and all that. And I had to have people take me to the bathroom and a big wheelchair.
When you're on the financial edge, when you don't have a lot of backup plans in place and something happens like this, it infiltrates every aspect of your life.
Voices from the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey. The Category 4 storm made landfall a year ago this week when it slammed into the Gulf Coast of Texas. 66 people died, and Harvey caused $125 billion in damage, making it the second costliest natural disaster in U.S. history. This is The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz, filling in for Tanzina Vega this week. And today, we begin in some of the communities hardest hit by Harvey. Jill Ament is a reporter and producer for the Texas Standard. She's been reporting from both Port Aransas, which was the site where Harvey first made landfall, and from the rural Beaumont region, which flooded so intensely that the city's water pumping stations were shut down. She talked to residents and city officials about how people are coping a year after the storm. Jill, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin with Harvey itself. For people who didn't live through the storm, remind us, what was the intensity of the hurricane at the time that it hit Texas, and how did it move across the state?
Yeah, so to give you a visual, if you're not familiar with the layout of Texas, Harvey made landfall in the state's coastal region, the coastal Bend region. So that area from Port Aransas up to Port O'Connor was where the eye wall hit. And so one of the hardest hit areas was Port Aransas, Texas, where we spent a lot of time. And these are very rural regions of Texas. But then as the storm progressed over days, we saw it move towards southeast Texas. Houston, obviously, was a big newsmaker with the amount of rain that it dropped there, and the images of people in their boats rescuing their neighbors. And then it moved towards the Beaumont area. So the scope of Harvey's landfall, it was several days, which was why it was such a catastrophic storm.
Right. And about that first place the storm hit, Port Aransas, what did it look like after Hurricane Harvey?
Well, I was not there right after the storm hit. I have gotten images and stories from the people who lived there, who were either there when the storm made landfall or came a couple of days after. And a couple of people that I spoke with specifically very recently was the Port Aransas mayor, who has lived in Port Aransas for most of his life. His family has lived there for more than 130 years.
This is absolutely the worst storm I've ever seen. It to be honest with you, when I first saw the damage, I couldn't speak. It was terrible.
And I also spoke with the town city manager who rode out the storm that night when Harvey made landfall. And they both, you know, told me from their time living in those areas, they had never seen anything as destructive as Harvey. The mayor described it to me as a monster. And he will never, you know, he'll never look at the Gulf Coast the same way. Unfortunately, the storm destroyed and damaged 100% of businesses in Port Aransas and 85% of homes. So they've had a lot of work to do, and they still have a lot of work to do.
Wow. And now a year later, how is Port Aransas doing in terms of recovery? Are businesses back up and running, at least some businesses?
So a lot of their efforts after the storm, you know, obviously when a storm hits, you want to clear out the town and the debris, and then you got to get homes gutted, and you've got to figure out where you're going to place displaced people. But Port Aransas is also a beloved beach community in Texas. It's a large tourist destination, and tourism, you know, accounts for a large portion of their economy. So one of their main goals as well was to get those businesses and restaurants and the beaches and the harbors back in shape so that they could bring in tourism for this past summer season, the 2018 summer season. So a lot of their rebuilding efforts have gone into getting these business owners back on their feet, rebuilding these businesses so they can bring back people. And it's gone, you know, relatively well. I would say that like Port Aransas is back in business, but that's really just like a surface level statement, because when it comes to the city itself, you know, the city itself, the mayor said, suffered up to about $1 billion of damage. When we're talking about just city infrastructure, that's $50 to $70 million, he told me. And a lot of those infrastructures have not been fully repaired, like their police department, their fire department, their public library. Those are not yet functioning. They can't go in there yet. So basically, that portion of the recovery is kind of put aside, though, so they can focus on getting tourism back to Port Aransas.
And then you have, obviously, housing, and you also talked to some residents in the region, including Christy and Danny McElroy.
They're actually residents of an area called Aransas Pass, which is in between Port Aransas and Rockport. Again, an area that was hit very hard by the initial landfall of Harvey. Christy and Danny have both lived in that area for their entire lives. When the storm was approaching and they were given evacuation notices, they evacuated. They weren't really sure what to expect. I don't think anybody expected what Harvey actually did. But they came back after the storm. Their home was a total loss. They were insured, so insurance was able to pay for a good portion of their repairs. What insurance did not pay for, they were able to find in donations. A lot of the recovery efforts in Aransas Pass, Port Aransas, across Texas, a lot of it's just been, you know, people stepping up for other people, neighbors, helping neighbors, and donating money, providing goods and services. So the McElroys definitely were receivers of that. And they also, you know, they're going to stay, they're going to rebuild from the ground up. They're in the process of it and they're almost done. They are hoping, what they told me specifically is that they want to move back in on August 25th, the year that yes. Harvey made landfall.
But I can tell you, if it happens again and I lose my house, I won't stay. I'll move North Texas, where my brother-in-law and that is, or Central Texas.
We dealt with a Cat 4 storm and we took a direct shot at it. And a lot of people that even stayed said, you know, even the older people, my elders, even said they'll never stay for another one. And a lot of people have never come home.
Jill Amon is a producer and reporter for the Texas Standard, and we're talking about recovery in the coastal bin a year after Hurricane Harvey. Jill, another area you've been reporting on that was also really hard hit is Beaumont, a rural region. Can you remind listeners why the flooding occurred there and what the consequences were?
So there was a huge amount of rainfall that fell in the Beaumont area. I specifically was in the Rose City area. In the Vidor areas, which is just outside of Beaumont. I believe about 30 inches of rain had fell by the time it was all said and done. And there's a levee outside of Beaumont that's just above Rose City. And the river was breaching the levee. And the Army Corps of Engineers decided that it would be appropriate to go ahead and let the... To open the levee, so in the case that, because they thought that it was going to break. Well, unfortunately, Rose City, it's very, very small town, and a very low income part of the region, was at the bottom of this levee. So they received, you know, initially the rainfall wasn't what flooded Rose City. It was the waters that came after the levee was open. Wow. And that's what took a lot of people off guard. I mean, there were evacuations again issued, but the couple that I spoke with specifically, Patricia and Linton Cowart, who again have lived in Rose City for since 1961. So, you know, a very long time, hadn't experienced anything like this. They were definitely taken by surprise. They did not evacuate because, again, they did not expect it to be as bad. But their house did end up flooding. I think they got about a foot of water in there, and they had to be evacuated by boat.
I do get very apprehensive when it rains a lot. And we have had a couple of storms or rains that we got like 5 inches of rain. It definitely has done something to us mentally. I'm sure it has everybody that lives down here.
Wow. I mean, the bottom line with all of this is things still are not fully back to normal a year after the storm. And now we're in another hurricane season. Before we leave you, can you tell us if these communities are feeling better prepared than they were last year?
I think people have definitely learned a lesson. Like, just speaking with the Cowarts, they know that after what happened last year, if they are given an evacuation notice or if things are starting to look bad, they will leave. They will not stay. And I think that that's definitely something that a lot of people that I've talked to who didn't evacuate would agree on. I think that there's a lot of apprehension as to when the next big storm is going to come, so to speak, and how to prepare for that.
Sure.
You know, even if it rains or just some thunder, the Cowarts, the ones that I spoke to in Rose City, they still get very nervous. So I think that there are definitely like some emotional and mental scars that people are feeling. But at the end of the day, you know, these people are from Texas. They love their communities, and they want to stay there. So right. I don't think that a lot of people that I spoke to have any intentions of leaving.
Jill Ament is a producer and reporter for the Texas Standard, talking to us 1 year to the week of Hurricane Harvey's devastation. Jill, thank you for your reporting.
Thanks for having me.
Across the nation, there's talk of a blue wave, but there's another trend this year. Nearly a dozen Republican candidates who espouse extremist, white supremacist, and anti-Semitic ideas.
So there's still a slew of candidates that are still on the ballot on the federal level for congressional seats and what have you.
Christopher Mathias covers hate and extremism for HuffPost.
You have Arthur Jones in Illinois, who is a straight-up neo-Nazi, who is a member of the American Nazi Party. You have John Fitzgerald in California, who's running for a congressional seat out there. He is a Holocaust denier. Rick Tyler, who's actually the only one that's running as an independent candidate who's not a Republican. In 2016, the last time he ran, he put up a billboard in Tennessee that said, Make America White Again. In New Jersey, you have Seth Grossman in the 2nd Congressional District. He's definitely expressed some very racist views. And then you've had people that have lost, like Paul Nehlen in Wisconsin, and kind of emerged that he was a very explicit like member of the alt-right. And then you have people who I would call white supremacists, like Steve King in Iowa, who is a sitting U.S. congressman, but I think whose history of bigotry definitely puts him in that category.
So I asked him, come the general election, what are the chances of these candidates being elected?
For the most part, they're all long shot candidates. They're not going to get into office. The one person that has a chance is the incumbent, Steve King. But what is worrying is that you had someone like Patrick Little, who is, you know, a raging anti-Semitic neo-Nazi in California, who was running for U.S. Senate and, you know, got like walloped, like only got like 1.5% of the vote. But that's still 90,000 votes for a neo-Nazi in California. And then you had Paul Nehlen, who lost in Wisconsin in the Republican primary the other week, still managed to get over 6,000 votes, which, you know, like he was a well-known quantity at that point. So people were choosing to vote for him.
Sure. So what I'm trying to grapple with is, are there more of these overt racist candidates now? Is this a trend, or are they just more visible because I see your Twitter feed, for example, and I read about them online? Are we just more aware of it, or are there actually more of these candidates?
I think it's a mixture of both. The Anti-Defamation League, which, you know, has tracked this stuff for a long time, has referred to this as a kind of a record number of white supremacist and extremist candidates. And also, another thing to take into the equation here is that if you're not only looking at federal candidates for federal office, there's a slew of candidates at state and local level that are white supremacists or have pretty extremist views. So that's something to consider as well.
We spoke to Republican strategist Ryan Williams, and we asked him what he thought about how GOP leaders should react to these types of extreme candidates.
In cases where candidates are clearly racist and new information comes to light that wasn't known before, I think that the appropriate step, and we see it taken frequently, is just to distance the party from that candidate and not to support their candidacy.
Is that the case? Is the GOP consistent in distancing itself from racist candidates? And how does the party handle others whose messaging about white supremacy may be a little more subtle?
Right. So when candidates like Arthur Jones, the neo-Nazi in Illinois, and Paul Nehlen, you know, the white supremacist in Wisconsin, kind of got into the news, the GOP, you know, quickly distanced themselves. Now, I think Steve King is a very good example of a candidate who routinely makes bigoted comments about Muslims and immigrants, and earlier this summer promoted a neo-Nazi on Twitter and then refused to delete that tweet or apologize for it. Hmm. And he, you know, was not roundly condemned by the GOP.
Right.
And I, you know, reached out for comment to the RNC and to the, you know, National Republican Congressional Committee to see if they would still support Steve King, you know, because of his history, and I never heard back. So while, you know, the GOP, maybe you could say, does a decent job at distancing themselves from kind of, you know, straight up neo-Nazis and what have you, I think people that are, you know, maybe more toe the line between being a white supremacist and a mainstream Republican, they don't denounce as loudly.
We have some tape of Steve King on MSNBC during the 2016 Republican National Convention. You might remember this in a conversation with MSNBC's Chris Hayes.
I mean, I'd ask you to go back through history and figure out where are these contributions that have been made by these other categories of people that you're talking about? Where did any other subgroup of people contribute more to civilization?
Than white people?
Than Western civilization itself that's rooted in Western Europe, Eastern Europe, and the United States of America.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly a reason why I think Steve King should be labeled a white supremacist, and we should stop kind of dancing around the fact. That's him saying that white people are essentially, you know, better and have contributed more to civilization. It's like, you know, textbook white supremacy.
So we plan to have you on before President Trump's tweet last night that reiterated a white nationalist talking point. Following a segment on Fox News, Trump criticized a South African plan to seize land from white landowners without compensation as a means of returning property to black landowners who lost their land during apartheid. And you tweeted that this is the result of a Nazi to Fox News to the White House propaganda pipeline. Tell me about that pipeline.
Sure. So the whole thing about white farmers in South Africa has been kind of a meme and a trope among white nationalists on the alt-right for years and years. That's like the only people, you know, you've really seen talk about this in America. Mm-hmm. So the discussions about that start on kind of alt-right and white nationalist message boards, where have you, eventually get picked up by, you know, further to, you know, maybe your Breitbart or your Daily Caller, and then gets picked up by Fox News, like what happened last night. And then as soon as that happened, the president tweeted it. And we've seen, you know, kind of this fringe Nazi to Fox News pipeline before, where you had like Tucker Carlson, for example, doing a segment on the It's Okay to Be White meme, which was a meme that, you know, started on neo-Nazi message boards on 4chan. And then he's talking about it suddenly on Fox News without giving the proper context.
Yeah.
And we all know that the president loves Fox News and that's where he gets a lot of his news. So it's very concerning that, you know, that kind of propaganda pipeline exists.
And then to take it a step further, the president sent a tweet like that. And does that set the tone that therefore allows and enables racists, overt racists, to think they can run for office as Republicans?
I mean, I think it certainly emboldens people and gives them a new permission and says, you know, you can hold, you run for public office, even hold public office and spout, you know, white nationalists talking points and maybe be fine. White nationalists and racists were thrilled last night over Donald Trump's South Africa tweet. David Duke, Mike Enoch, Nick Fuentes were all tweeting about how excited and over the moon they were that Trump was doing that.
Christopher Mathias covers hate and extremism for HuffPost. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
It's Matt Katz here, filling in on The Takeaway. And here we are. It's the end of August, and maybe you're looking to squeeze in a little more time on the beach before the end of the summer. I've already been down to the Jersey Shore with my family because there is nothing like running in and out of the surf and riding some waves in the Atlantic. All I had to worry about was some jellyfish, maybe seaweed getting tangled on my legs. It's not like I had to concern myself with sharks or anything. They're not in the New York, New Jersey area, right?
The short answer is they're everywhere. They're widespread along the whole south shore of Long Island based on our tracking data and catch records, right from just the mouth of the Hudson River all the way out to Montauk. It seems like they're spending most of their time a mile or so off the beach, so they definitely make runs in very close to shore, depending on where their food is, and that's what these sharks are doing out there. They're following their food.
That's Toby Curtis, Fishery Management Specialist for the National Marine Fisheries Service.
The sharks are there. You might even be within, 20 feet of a shark at some point. You'd never know that they were there because they're there looking for fish. And so occasionally they do come close to shore, but generally they're sort of beyond the range of where people are swimming. There's really very little risk for people going swimming at the ocean beaches.
Very little risk, says Toby Curtis, and his colleague veterinarian Harley Newton tells me any fear of sharks that we may have is misplaced.
I grew up in an era that was post-Jaws, and I think Everyone's typical response to that was to be afraid of them, and all I wanted to know was how you became Hooper.
What we are dealing with here is a perfect engine, an eating machine. All this machine does is swim and eat and make little sharks, and that's all.
And I think I used my veterinary degree in order to really achieve that. And I felt really fortunate when Toby invited me to be a part of his project and look at the health of this juvenile white shark population off the coast of New York.
Harley is the head of aquatic health for the Wildlife Conservation Society at the New York Aquarium. She's part of a team led by Toby Curtis conducting field research on this juvenile white shark population in the waters around New York City. I spoke to them both about their passion for these sharks and what led them to this field of work.
White sharks have sort of been a lifelong fascination of mine, and I read that there's sort of a number of small white sharks have been documented off the coast of Long Island going back to the 1960s, and it's sort of been suspected that there may be a nursery area there for white sharks. I moved back to the Northeast and had this opportunity to start fishing with another college friend of mine, Greg Metzger from the South Fork Natural History Museum. And we were just sort of like, hey, we know these little white sharks are in the area, but no one's really taken a hard look at them from a scientific perspective. No one's tried to tag them yet and understand what they're doing here and when they're here and some of the real basic questions. So we started putting a project together and we were able to get some tags out. And fortunately, over the last few years, we've had a lot of success and we've learned a great deal about the juvenile white sharks that occur off Long Island.
And people might not be aware that the waters around New York are teeming with oceanic life. Can you tell us a little bit about the area, Toby?
There's abundant marine life off New York, and it's really kind of fascinating. We're right in the shadows of New York City and millions of people, but the ocean is a healthy and vibrant place. So there's a lot of marine life from some sort of the base of the food chain, your forage, bait fish, things like bunker and mackerel. They're doing really well now. And when you have that abundant prey, it brings a lot of the predators back too. So sharks and dolphins and whales and tunas and things like that. So people that spend time in the water, they're seeing this sort of increase in the marine life. just in general in the whole New York region.
And the increase in white sharks specifically, is the population of white sharks growing elsewhere, or is it really specific to this area?
Sort of coast-wide, we have some evidence that the white shark population is increasing. During the 1970s and 1980s, there was an overfishing problem, and the population declined along with many other sharks along the U.S. coast. But since the 1990s, we've had various fisheries management regulations put in place, and a number of shark populations appear to be, you know, responding and rebuilding. The white sharks, they've been here all along, and the data we're collecting now will sort of help enhance those conservation and fisheries management goals.
Harley, as a veterinarian, why are you excited about working with white sharks?
Similar to Toby, it was always a lifelong dream to work with sharks. They're such an iconic species. There's so many people doing great research on them. Never would have thought I would have had the opportunity to actually work with them. I still remember the very first day I ever saw a white shark, and every single one since then has been special.
And how old are these sharks? You said these are juvenile white sharks. So how old are they?
Most of the ones that we're working on are young of the year, so within the first year of their life. We've had a few more recently that were slightly older than that.
And how big is the animal? I'm trying to envision this. How big is the shark?
So these guys, the young of the year, they're actually quite small.
Uh-huh.
But they look like perfect miniatures of the adults. I'll always remember the first time I ever saw one because I was so struck by how they are just proportionately just like somebody shrunk.
Wow.
A giant gray white shark. I'd say they're between like 130 centimeters is the smallest that we've probably done. They weigh around like 100 pounds to 170 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
They're not big.
Is there something unique about working with a shark at that life cycle as opposed to fully grown shark?
From a health perspective, it's a really important baseline to have.
Yeah.
You know, what we're really interested in looking at when we're looking at the health of populations is what normal is.
Sure.
So we're looking for blood counts, chemistry values, the kind of stuff that when you go to the doctor and get your blood drawn, you take for granted the fact that they know what those numbers mean. We're still really working on that in sharks. So being able to study this juvenile population that's pretty much naive to sort of all of the different possible environmental stressors or other disease processes, it just makes them really important.
And so, Toby, for this project, you get this team together and you go out on a boat and you just start looking for sharks. Tell us what this work is like. How do you find them? Are they difficult to catch?
So, in short, yes, they are difficult to catch. It takes a lot of effort to sort of catch these juvenile white sharks. But we've been at it for, you know, several years now. We've sort of fine-tuned where to look and kind of, you know, match the water conditions and look for the food. And, you know, we think we find a good spot. We can get on the sharks relatively quickly. And it's been a learning process over the last several years to fine tune that.
And then what happens when you catch one? You bring them onto the boat and then what happens?
The sharks that we're handling now, we're generally working them up over the side of the boat. So they stay in the water.
Oh, okay.
So we hook them, we reel them in as quickly as we can to reduce the stress on them. They're sort of secured to the side of the boat. And then once they're secure, we can sort of get the shark to calm down, and then we can take all of our samples and attach tags. Harley and others can draw the blood. So we try to do a quick workup that takes, you know, usually 5 to 10 minutes or so while the shark is alongside the boat. Then we unhook it and send it on its way and then wait for the data to come back to us. And what we're really trying to do now is get a better handle on sort of high resolution movements of what these fish are doing when they're cruising the Long Island coastline.
Toby, ultimately, what are you hoping to see from this research? What kinds of questions are you hoping this data will lead you to ask?
Yeah, so ultimately for me, it's getting a better handle on the ecology of the juvenile white sharks and other species in the area off Long Island. We want to get a handle on their role in the ecosystem and just understand the sort of habitat patterns of the sharks. What kind of depths do they like to swim in? What kind of temperatures do they prefer? And with that information, we can share that data with fisheries managers and decision makers and ocean resource managers. And just, you know, when they're looking to study the impacts of human activities in the region, we can share that data and say, hey, look, you know, maybe this is going to have some impact on the white shark population. So it has to do with the fisheries, ocean resource use, like offshore energy development, things like that, as well as climate change in the long term. The data we collect is very interesting from just a strictly ecological standpoint, but also has conservation implications in the long term.
Harley Newton is a veterinarian and the head of aquatic health for the Wildlife Conservation Society, and Toby Curtis is a fishery management specialist for the National Marine Fisheries Service. Thank you to you both, and enjoy the sharks.
Thanks very
so
much.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
And that's our show and a wrap for me this week. Amy Walter is here tomorrow, as usual. Tanzina is on vacation next week, and my WNYC colleague Cindy Rodriguez will be here on Monday. I'll be back with you all on Thursday. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at MattKatz00. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, and this is The Takeaway.
Before Cohen, before Manafort, something else was already on the minds of American voters.
Healthcare is my number one issue.
Healthcare is very important to me.
It is my number one concern as a voter.
How will healthcare shape the November midterms? We hear from the experts and from you. I'm Amy Walter, and that's next time on the Takeaway Podcast.